What should politicians say when asked about evolution? Dr. Stephen Meyer asked and answered that question recently. Dr. Meyer earned his PhD in the philosophy of science at Cambridge University. He also wrote the New York Times bestseller, Darwin's Doubt. And, of course, Dr. Meyer works with the Discovery Institute. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to Vocal Point. Good to have you again.
Well, it's always good to be with you, Jerry.
Now, it was a very famous question that was asked by a British politician or some British official when Scott Walker was visiting in England about 2 months ago. What do you think about evolution? And he basically punted on that. What do you think politicians should answer? They should be ready for an answer if they're asked about that question, especially if they believe in the Bible.
Well, you know, poor old Scott Walker was not prepared to be asked about evolution. He was actually in England talking about trade relationships between Wisconsin and the United Kingdom. So it was kind of caught him by surprise. But so he went deer in the headlights, and he said, well, that's above my pay grade. I think that's not something politicians should get involved in answering one way or another. And to the British reporters, that was a kind of a confession of scientific ignorance. In fact, he said, I'm going to punt on that one. That's a question a politician shouldn't be involved in one way or another, so I'm going to leave that up to you. And the British media just skewered him, and a lot of media in the States did as well, because he looked unprepared, he looked evasive, and he looked scientifically uninformed. And the thing is that Walker isn't the first politician to have been kind of caught off guard by that. Typically, people on the conservative side of the political divide are put on the defensive about this very, very quickly. People on the liberal side tend to just say, yeah, I believe in evolution, and the media is happy with that. But people on the conservative side know that either they themselves or many people in their constituency are skeptical about evolution. And so then they will sometimes start talking about their belief in the Bible, or they'll get Mike Huckabee was asked a couple years ago, and he sounded very flippant. He said, if anybody wants to believe that they're the descendants of a primate, they're certainly welcome to do that. And then he kind of laughed it off. But there are much better answers available to politicians that show they're serious, that they're committed to academic freedom, and that they're up to date on what's going on scientifically.
All right, and I'll have you explore those. But first, let me ask you this. Here's how I think I would answer it, not that I'm running for any office or running from any office, but here we go. If somebody asked me, do you believe in evolution?
Well, I know lots of people that would vote for you.
Well, thank you very much. All right, here we go. I don't think the dog catcher position is available in Broward County. All right, here we go. Do I believe in evolution? I believe in microevolution, which is small changes within kind, but I do not believe that there's even any evidence for macroevolution, which is really the heart of the controversy. That would be my answer. What would you say to that?
Well,
feel free to critique it.
Start, and that's one of the things that I said in the explained in the presentation I made on Capitol Hill, and also
tell us about that. Tell us about that Capitol Hill presentation. That's fascinating.
Well, there's a group there on in the Capitol of congressional aides and other people from the various think tanks in D.C. that meet, and they call their group Faith and Law. And they invited me to give a talk about this very topic.
Neat.
And one of the first things I did in the talk was explain why it's such a difficult question to answer. Because evolution, as your answer indicates, can mean many different things. It can mean very small-scale microevolutionary variations, which no one disputes, like the Galapagos finches, the beaks of which will get smaller or larger in response to varying weather patterns or climatic patterns. It can also mean the idea of universal common ancestry, that all organisms are related by common ancestry back to some very simple one-celled organism, and that everything has morphed and changed gradually over time from such a simple form of life. And it can also mean the idea that a purely undirected, unguided process, namely natural selection and random mutation, has produced all the forms of life we see today and all the big changes that we see in the history of life. And that gets to your idea of macroevolution. So that's a lot of different meanings associated with one word. And And so one of the things I recommended is that if people say exactly what you did, I believe that evolution can produce small-scale change over time, but I'm skeptical that it can produce the large-scale changes that we've seen in the history of life. And I'm also skeptical of unguided evolution, which is the Darwinian meaning of the term that is loaded metaphysically and religiously. It says that there's no design, no guidance, no creative anything behind the evolutionary process, and that's the Darwinian meaning that most kids learn in school. So, I counsel politicians to express skepticism about that. There's not good evidence for it, and yet it's part of what it's part of what goes along. It's the baggage of the term that goes along with it in the popular discussion.
We're talking right now with Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of the book Darwin's Doubt. He spoke at Capitol Hill, actually, to a briefing of staff aides and so forth, on the subject of what should politicians say when asked about evolution. And Dr. Meyer has written a book called Darwin's Doubt. Also, there was a bestseller a few years before called Signature in the Cell. Now, after Governor Walker's remarks, and he was asked the question and so forth, and then he tweeted out some sort of message along the lines of God and evolution are not irreconcilable. I remember seeing George Will on Fox News, and he basically threw all, you know, creation scientists or intelligent design people under the bus, it seemed to me. He said, look, get over it. Evolution is a fact. End of story. If you have any questions, just look at the fossil record. And I'm thinking, the fossil record? Wait a minute. Doesn't that kind of show, all creatures fully formed? In fact, your book, Darwin's Doubt, has a whole focus on the Cambrian explosion.
Right. Well, George Will is someone that I've admired for years, and it rather saddened me when I heard that he had announced publicly that he's an atheist. And he, I know, was influenced by Stephen Jay Gould. They shared a common love of baseball, and Gould was a leading evolutionary biologist at Harvard. But this is actually one of the themes of my book. There's a huge disparity between the popular presentation of the status of evolutionary theory by, for example, the science writers at the New York Times or textbook writers that our students, of the books our students read, or by people like Bill Nye, the science guy, or Richard Dawkins. And people like that have influenced a lot of opinion shapers in America, the people in the media, even people who are, might otherwise be inclined to take a contrarian point of view on something. So you have a conservative commentator like George Will, who's got lots of really insightful opinions to offer about other stuff, but he honestly knows nothing about this subject. And the fossil record certainly does not support Darwinian evolution. It's one of the longstanding problems with the theory, and it certainly doesn't support the origin of the first animal life arising in a gradualistic undirected way in which Darwin envisioned. And the odd thing is that Darwin knew that all the way back in 1859. It was one of the things that one of the doubts he expressed about the adequacy of his theory right in The Origin of Species. And that problem, as I show in the book, Darwin's Doubt, has not gotten better. It's gotten more acute in the 155 some odd years since he wrote the book. So there's a problem. There's a gap in our in the public presentation of the status of the theory by popularizers and people in the media, and the actual status of the theory as we find it in the technical biological literature. What I show in the book is that not only did Darwin have doubts about the adequacy of his own theory with respect to the fossil record of the Cambrian, but that problem has grown more acute, and many leading evolutionary biologists today recognize that the geologically abrupt appearance of the first animals in the fossil record is a big problem for Darwinian evolution, and it illustrates an even deeper problem, which is the problem of how the evolutionary process would build complex animals at all, given what we know about the importance of, for example, DNA and the information that's stored in the molecule. So there's a lot of big problems with evolutionary theory that aren't making it into the popular media. And so there's a false impression of how strong the evidence is in support of the theory.
Okay, explain to us the Cambrian explosion.
Well, the Cambrian explosion is the event in the history of life. It refers to an event in the history of life where the first animals appear very abruptly in the fossil record. And this, as I said, troubled Darwin. He knew that this was inconsistent with his idea that life had evolved in a very slow and gradual way. And it has remained a problem right to the present, as the fossil record has actually accentuated the problem of the Cambrian explosion by showing that even more animal forms arose abruptly at that time than even Darwin knew about. And in my book, I also explain how the fossil problem isn't even the deepest problem. The deepest problem is explaining where the evolutionary process would have gotten all the code, the information that's necessary to build these animals. We know since Watson and Crick that there's a molecule called DNA which stores information in a digital form for building all the crucial proteins that are needed to keep cells alive. So anytime you have in the history of life a big infusion of new biological form where you have lots of new animals or plants arising, especially if they do so abruptly, it raises the question not only of where are the missing ancestors in the lower strata, but where did all the code come from to build these new structures, these new anatomical structures and organisms? That's the real problem. Where did that information come from? And that's a big part of what my book is about. And it's a big part. It's one of the big problems that evolutionary biologists are having to grapple with that was not really even appreciated by Darwin in his time because he didn't know about DNA and he didn't know about the information-bearing content of these crucial molecules.
All right, now, just the word itself, Cambrian, is in reference to one of the geological ages. Everybody's familiar because of the movie to the phrase Jurassic, Jurassic Park, obviously. But Jurassic was one of the geological stages, and Cambrian stage, the Cambrian phase or whatever, came earlier. The Cambrian period came before the Jurassic, correct? And there were other ones in between.
Right, the Cambrian period is very much earlier than the Jurassic. The Jurassic period is the age of the dinosaurs, and the Cambrian period goes back several hundred million years before that, and that's the period in which the
according
first
to,
complex animals arise in the fossil record.
According to geological, this is standard geological theory.
Yeah, the standard geological timescale, and I'm of course aware there's a debate, especially in Christian circles, about the age of the Earth and how you interpret the days of Genesis. But on the standard geological timescale, the Cambrian period occurs long before the Jurassic period. But the same problem recurs throughout the history of life when you see fundamentally new forms of life arising. These are the macroevolutionary changes that you were talking about, Jerry.
Yeah.
The evolutionary theory does not have a good explanation of what caused those changes to arise. And that's because there isn't a mechanism that can produce all the new code that you need to produce all those new forms of life. The standard Darwinian mechanism, the modern Darwinian mechanism, is the idea of natural selection acting on random genetic mutations, where mutations are copying errors in sections of DNA text. Well, we know that if you make random changes to a section of functional software, for example, you're going to degrade that information long before you're going to come up with a new operating system or a new computer program. And so relying on a mechanism that degrades information as an explanation for the origin of new information is actually incongruous. It doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's kind of like we see all around us the principle of entropy. And in a sense, evolution is saying, no, the exact opposite is true. Don't believe your lying eyes.
Well, yeah, entropy is a little bit different issue because it has to do with the concept of order. And there are ways in which order can arise by spontaneously. If you pump energy through a system, if you, think of a tornado, you have the right kind of wind will create a nice symmetrical vortex, which is a kind of order. But what we've discovered is really the key to biological function is not so much order as information. And an informational sequence is not something that is perfectly symmetrical or repeats over and over again like a crystal or a tornado. It's something more like the information you find in a book or a piece of software where it's not totally predictable, but it is intelligible. It's making sense.
Yeah.
And we've never seen, there is no natural process that we know of that generates information spontaneously. The only thing that we know that produces information is intelligence, is a mind. And so the discovery of information at the foundation of life, I argue in my books, is a decisive indicator of the activity of a designing intelligence. And the Cambrian explosion is just one of many events in which there's a huge infusion of information into the biosphere. And we know that because we've got a whole lot of new biological form and structure, and we know what it takes to build that. It takes code. So that raises the question, where did the code come from? Evolutionary theory does not have a good explanation for that, but the theory of intelligent design does.
Huh. And not only that, but it would seem to me that the changes within the structures or whatever that they assume occurred, is there the time for that? You know, during the Cambrian explosion? Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah,
in other words,
on the standard, even on the standard time scale, this Cambrian event encompasses about 10 million years. People quibble about the dates. That's a lot of time on the human life scale, on the time scale of human history, but it's a blink of the eye geologically, and it's also a blink of an eye biologically. The modern Darwinian mechanism of mutation and natural selection takes a great deal of time to produce even very small changes. And in the book, I actually look at this mathematically and show that
it would be impossible.
There's a branch of evolutionary theory where the biologists can calculate how much time they should have to wait for a given evolutionary change to take place, given what we know about, say, the mutation rates or the size of populations or factors like that. And when people make calculations about the amount of time that would be required, even for a few coordinated mutations, to say nothing of the thousands of mutations you'd need to build a Cambrian animal, the waiting times end up far exceeding the time available to the Cambrian explosion, and even end up exceeding the time available to the entire evolutionary process on planet Earth. So the time available is just not sufficient to generate the kind of change we see with the explosion of animal life in the Cambrian period.
Are there any fossils that we could point to or that evolutionists can point to and say, look, see, this is evolution in progress?
Yeah, there are. But the question is, what do they prove or what do they show? And there's a pretty well-established sequence of fossils showing that horse-like forms have varied over time. But whether that really is establishing the kind of macroevolutionary innovation that we've been talking about, where you get a fundamentally new form of life arising, is a different question. There are debates about whether or not
I'm sorry for interrupting, but in a sense, what you've got is a huge extrapolation. You know, oh, look, we can see these changes within the horses, and therefore we can assume that the horse, you know, evolved into some other animal or vice versa.
There are isolated groups of organisms where you can make a plausible case that there's been a sequence. There's this group called the mammal-like reptiles that are arguably, on the basis of bone structure, intermediate to reptiles and mammals. But there's a lot of problems with the sequence, and so there's good counter-arguments as well. The sequence, the fossils are found in very diverse locales. They're presented in textbooks as a kind of nice, smooth gradation from the smallest of these forms to the largest, when in fact in the fossil record, you get big things becoming really small and small things becoming really big. And then the soft tissues of these organisms don't seem to exhibit a gradation of kind or structure at all. So even the things that look like they might be good sequences aren't so good when you look at them really carefully.
Hmm.
But the main point I make in my book is when you're looking at the big divisions of life, like the first animals, the groups of animals that exemplify unique body plans, you have a completely discontinuous fossil record. And that alone ought to give us pause about the Darwinian tree of life picture of the history of life, let alone the idea that the Darwinian mechanism of mutation and selection can produce all that form.
Hmm. We're talking right now with Dr. Stephen Meyer. Again, he's the author of the book Darwin's Doubt. Your website is what?
It's darwinsdoubt.com.
Well, that's
no
easy.
Apostrophe in the website address, yeah.
All right, good. So this is Vocal Point, by the way, and I'm Jerry Newcomb. And the original question on the table is, what should a politician say when asked about evolution? So let me turn it around and say, okay, Dr. Meyer, suppose you were running for dog catcher or whatever, and you were asked, do you believe in evolution? What would you say?
Well, what I would say is that, of course, I believe that organisms have changed over time. I certainly believe in evolution in that sense, but I'm skeptical about large-scale, unguided evolution, the idea that natural selection and random mutations have produced the major changes in the history of life that we observe today, and that they've done so without any guidance or design.
So that's your answer in a nutshell. Okay, good. I like
that's
that.
That's my answer in a nutshell. And if you want a longer answer, and I gave the politicians a sample answer that included one, I also would go on to say that also I'm aware, and maybe the public should be aware, that in peer-reviewed scientific publications, many scientists are now expressing doubts about the creative power of the Darwinian natural selection and random mutation mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that students should learn when they're learning about Darwin's theory, which they should learn about it, but they should learn about why scientists have these doubts, because it's important to understand the strengths and weaknesses of scientific theories, that's a matter of basic scientific literacy. And Darwinism has scientific weaknesses, and if students don't learn about those, they're being indoctrinated. They're not actually learning science the way science should be taught.
Yeah, and science isn't just what the scientists say it is, and then science isn't, 100% true or pure, because a lot of times the scientists, if they're honest, they have to revise their theories. And so, therefore, sometimes the scientific consensus sometimes might be 99% to 1, but if that 1% has the truth at the end of the day, eventually over time, if they're honest, the 99% will shift over, to embrace what is true.
Well, one of the things that I learned in the field of philosophy of science is that science advances as scientists argue about how to interpret the evidence. And when there is an argument about how to interpret evidence, that relates to a theory that students are learning, they ought to get to know the arguments pro and con. They shouldn't just be told one side of the argument or told what the status of the theory was 50 years ago. And the key point I'm making to politicians is don't be intimidated by the alleged media consensus around the issue of evolution. When you look in the technical peer-reviewed literature in evolutionary biology, what you find are many biologists openly acknowledging problems with the standard textbook theory of evolution, and many are now calling for a new theory of evolution because they know that natural selection and random mutation has very limited creative power. And in my book, Darwin's Doubt, I actually looked at, there are 6 or 7 new theories of evolution that have been proposed, and I examined those theories, and I critique those theories. And the fact that there are 7 new theories that are post-neo-Darwinian shows that the theory that everyone learns in the textbooks is obsolete. So, and that there is debate going on in the field about which theory is correct. And so at the very least, students should know that there's that kind of ferment going on, and that there isn't that the answer that they're being given in the textbooks is not the final answer.
I'm amazed that even now, as of this taping time, which is in the spring of 2015, even now, there are still reports of textbooks that have Haeckel's embryos, the drawings of Haeckel's embryos, which are definitely pro-Darwinian, but apparently they're not factually true, and they've been proven not true, and yet they're still showing up in some of the textbooks.
It's appalling, actually. A number of the textbooks have corrected that problem. These are you're referring to the pictures that were drawn by Ernst Haeckel, the famous German 19th century embryologist and evolutionary biologist. These pictures allegedly show that different classes of vertebrate embryos go through similar developmental stages. And we actually now know that that's not true. In fact, it was known since 1894. There was a famous British embryologist named Adam Sedgwick who showed that Haeckel's diagrams were inaccurate. Stephen Jay Gould complained before he died about the endless recycling of these pictures in textbooks and said that we had a right to be appalled by this. It was such bad science and bad science education. We started making complaints about this false evidence in the biology textbooks before textbook committee hearings back around the 2000-2001, and some textbook companies have taken them out, but they're still being used in other textbooks. And some took out the drawings, but then used photographs that allegedly showed the same thing. So this is why I think it's very important that when students are learning about evolution, they are allowed to learn about the critiques, both of the theory and also critiques of evidence that shouldn't even be in the books because it's known to be factually false.
Now, when you were describing some of the changes that were taking place during the Cambrian explosion, you know, some of the actual phenomenon, I thought of an analogy, and I don't know if it's any good, but what if somebody came across a copy of Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities? They would look at this book and say, wow, this is really an amazing piece of work, you know, and it just evolved. It just happened. I mean, in other words, there was obviously an intelligent designer, a creator of it. And yet, in a sense, the universe and even the specific organisms within the Cambrian period show a greater amount of sophistication, as I understand it, than even the Tale of Two Cities.
Well, every organism has a genome, and every genome contains information in a digital form. The characters of the genetic text are specific chemicals called nucleotide bases, and there are four different kinds of them, and the arrangement of those bases provides information that tells the cell how to direct its important protein parts and protein machines. Now, when this was first discovered in the late 1950s and 60s, Francis Crick had a breakthrough insight. He and Watson had figured out the structure of the DNA molecule in 1953, but in 1957, Crick proposed something called the sequence hypothesis. And he realized that these nucleotide bases, these four chemicals, are functioning just like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters like the zeros and ones in a section of machine code or computer code. And, which is to say, it's not the chemicals' properties or the shape of these molecules that gives them their function. It's their arrangement in accord with a symbol convention. And this was just an amazing stop press moment in the history of biology, because what then was increasingly realized is that we have information inside living cells that is directing all these important cellular processes. Information is running the show inside
Wow.
life. And that raises a huge question, which is, where does that information come from? And your analogy to Charles Dickens gets at what is a key argument in my book, which is that what we know from experience is that information, especially if we find it in an alphabetic or a digital form, always arises from an intelligent source, from a mind, not an undirected material process. Whether we're looking at a section of computer code or a text in a book or a hieroglyphic inscription or even information that's embedded in a radio signal, if we trace it back to its source, we always come to a mind, to an intelligent cause, not an undirected process. So the discovery that information is running the show at the foundation of life, and that big infusions of information, such as occur in the Cambrian explosion, have occurred in the history of life, I think those discoveries point to the reality of a designing intelligence working throughout life's history. And I think that's the basis of our theory of intelligent design. And it's based, notice, on our uniform and repeated experience, which is supposed to be the basis of all scientific reasoning. We know that it takes a mind to produce information. We know of no exceptions to that rule, and therefore the presence of information is a decisive indicator of intelligent design.
Darwin'sDoubt.com for more information. Stephen Meyer, thanks so much for being with us. And how about a 10-second answer if a politician were asked, do you believe in evolution? What would be your 10-second advice to the politician? And with that, we'll close.
I believe I believe that life has changed over time, but I don't believe in undirected evolution. That'd be the shortest way at it.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer, for joining us. Again, darwinsdoubt.com for more information. All the best.
Thank you, Jerry.